Continuing on our subject of written tests, we're now going to go over usability. A measuring instrument, including a written test, should be usable. A usable written test is easy to give. It is written in a type size large enough for students to easily read. The wording of both the directions for taking the test and the test items themselves is clear and concise. Graphs, charts, and illustrations are appropriate to the test items and are clearly drawn, and the test is easily graded. Then there's comprehensiveness. A measuring instrument, including again a written test, must sample liberally whatever is being measured. Suppose, for example, the owner of a grain elevator wants to evaluate a carload of wheat. If a bushel of wheat from the top of the carload is analyzed, the test would be poor, one that is not sufficiently comprehensive. A judgment based on this evaluation could not be safely applied to the entire carload. The wheat at the bottom of the car might be infested with insects. However, if 50 test tubes of wheat are taken from the scattered positions throughout the carload, less than a bushel of wheat might be analyzed, but a much more comprehensive evaluation of the contents of the car would be obtained. In classroom evaluation, a test must sample liberally the objectives of instruction. The comprehensiveness of a test is the degree to which the scope of the course objectives is but a sample of that entire course. Just as the owner of the wheat has to select samples of wheat from scattered positions in the car, the instructor has to make certain that the evaluation includes a representative and comprehensive samplings of the objectives of the course. In both instances, the evaluators must deliberately take comprehensive examples. It's time now to talk about discrimination. A measuring instrument, again including a written test, must be constructed in such a way that it will detect small differences. Suppose, for example, that a machinist wishes to measure 6 bearings that are slightly graduated in size. If a ruler is used to measure the diameters of the bearings, little difference will be found between the smallest bearing and the second smallest one. Now, if the machinist compares the third bearing with the first bearing, slight differences might be detected, but the ruler could not be depended on for accurately assorting the 6 bearings. However, if the machinist measures with a micrometer, which can measure very, very fine graduations, the diameters of the first and the second bearings, and the second and the third bearings, and so on, can be easily differentiated. Thus the term discrimination. In classroom evaluations, a test must be able to measure small differences in achievement in relation to the objectives of the course. When a test is constructed to identify the difference in the achievement of students, it has 3 features. 1, there should be a wide range of scores. 2, all levels of difficulty are included. And 3, each item distinguishes between the students who are low and those who are high in achievement of the course objectives. Written test items. Test items fall into 2 general categories, the sample type and the selection type item. Items of the first category require the student to furnish a response in the form of a word, sentence, or paragraph. The second category includes items for which 2 or more alternative responses are provided. The supply type test items. This type item may be required where no select type items can be devised to secure adequate evaluation of the student accomplishment. The supply type item requires the student to organize their knowledge. It demands an ability to express ideas that is not required for a selection type item. It permits the students also to tell all they know about a subject even though they do not know the complete answer. This type item is valuable in measuring the student's generalization or generalized understanding of a particular subject. On the other hand, a supply type item may evaluate the student's ability to write rather than their specific knowledge of subject matter. It places a premium on neatness and penmanship. The main disadvantage of tests containing supply type items is that they cannot be graded with uniformity. This is important to note. There is no assurance that the grade assigned is the grade deserved by the student. The same test graded by different instructors would probably be assigned different scores. That's why it doesn't have uniformity. The same test graded by the same instructor on consecutive days might be assigned two altogether different scores. Still, another disadvantage of a test consisting of supply type items is the time required by the student to complete it, and then also the time required by the instructor to grade it. Everything considered, the disadvantages of the supply type item appear to exceed its advantages to such an extent that most instructors prefer to use the selection type item whenever possible. So let's go over the selection type test items. Written tests made up of selection type items are highly objective. In other words, the results of such a test would be graded the same regardless of the student taking the test or the person grading it. So tests which include only selection type items make it possible to directly compare student accomplishment. Here's an example. It is possible to compare the performance of students within the same class or in different classes, students under one instructor with those under another instructor, student accomplishment at one stage of instruction with that of a latter stage, or to compare student learning under one method of instruction to that of another method. By using selection type items, the instructor can test many more areas of knowledge in a given time that could be done by requiring the student to supply written responses. This increase in comprehensiveness can be expected to increase validity and discrimination. Another advantage is that selection type test items are well adapted to statistical item analysis. Now let's take time to go over true-false test items. This test item, with all its variations, has a wide range of usage. It is well adapted to the testing of knowledge of facts and details, especially when there are only two possible answers. The chief disadvantage is that the probability of guessing in the simple true-false item is greater than in any other type test item. True-false test items are probably used and misused more than any other selection type item. Frequently, instructors merely score textual material, select sentences more or less at random, and make half of them false by inserting negatives. They mistakenly believe they can justify these answers by referring students to pages in the text. When tests are constructed in this way, the principal attribute being measured is photographic memory. Such tests constructed has aroused antagonism toward selection tests in general and true and false items in particular. It has also decreased the validity of educational evaluations. Let's take some time now to go over seven principles which should be followed in the construction of true-false item questions. Here we go. Include only one idea in each statement. 2. Avoid the unnecessary use of negatives. They tend to confuse the reader. 3. Avoid involved statements. Keeping wording and sentence structure as simple as possible and make the statements both definite and clear. 4. Whenever possible, use terms which mean the same thing to all students. 5. Avoid absolutes such as all, every, only, no, and never. Since unequivocally true or false statements are rare, statements containing absolutes are usually false. Similarly, avoid statements containing some, any, and generally. These words are known as determiners and provide clues to the correct answer. 6. Avoid patterns in the sequence of correct responses because students can often identify the patterns. Instructors sometimes deliberately use patterns to make hand scoring easier. This is a poor practice. And the last one, 7, make statements brief and about the same length. Students are quick to take advantage of this tendency. That concludes our discussion on true-false test items. Let's take some time and discuss now multiple choice test items. When properly devised and constructed, this item type offers several unique advantages which make it more widely used and versatile than either the matching or the true-false items. This type of item may be used to determine student achievement, ranging from acquisition of facts to understanding, reasoning, and the ability to apply what has been learned. They are appropriate to use when the problem, 1, has a built-in and unique solution, for example, specific application of laws or principles, Or number two, may be clearly limited by the wording of the item so that the student may choose the best of several offered solutions rather than a universal solution. Number three, in such that several options are plausible or even scientifically accurate, but the student may be asked to identify the one most pertinent. And four, it has several pertinent solutions and the student may be asked to identify the most appropriate solution. There are three major difficulties that we're going to encounter in the construction of multiple choice test items. Let's go over them. Number one, development of a question or an item stem which can be expressed clearly and without ambiguity. In other words, without the possibility of two or more meanings. Second, statement of an answer which cannot be refuted. And third, the invention of lures or distractors which will be attractive to those students who do not possess the knowledge or understanding necessary to recognize the correct answer. A multiple choice item may also take several basic forms. Number one, it may be a direct question followed by several possible answers. It may be an incomplete sentence followed by possible completions of that sentence or service. Or it may be a stated problem, a graph or a diagram, followed by several correct or incorrect statements covering that problem, that graph or diagram. So the student may be asked to select the one choice that is the correct answer or completion, the one choice which is an incorrect answer or completion, or the one choice which is the best of the answers presented in the test item. These three methods of answering combined with the three item forms give the test constructor a number of possible ways of setting up a multiple choice question to measure a given ability. Experience has shown, however, that beginners are more successful with the question form. Our next area of discussion is the use of instructional aids. A good teacher or instructor is a master not only of getting the student's attention, but also keeping it. Want to get a young kid's attention? Start by asking, "Do you want to hear a story?" That gets them excited. Adults, on the other hand, that's a little different. We have to be creative in using instructional aids. Instructors can use instructional aids to improve communication between themselves and their students. They may be either sight or sound devices or a combination of both. The key factor is that the aids support, supplement, and reinforce what's being taught. While instructors may be involved in actually preparing aids, their main function is to plan the use of aids so that they help to achieve maximum learning. They must understand some of the theories behind aids, some reasons for using aids, and some guidelines for their use. They should also be familiar with different types of instructional aids. Let's take some time and go over the theory behind the use of instructional aids. For many years, experts have been theorizing concerning the activity which takes place within the human brain during the communicative process. There is much difference of opinion and little positive agreement concerning this matter. However, there is general agreement about three items of theory that seem pertinent to an understanding of the use of aids. So let's take a little time and go over those three. The first one, during the communicative process, the mind acts as a filter. As great numbers of verbal or visual bits of communication are received, the brain works to sort out the important items from the routine descriptive or supportive items. Therefore, learning can probably be furthered by helping to identify the important bits. One way to do this, of course, is by using aids to emphasize them. The second, the brain also tries to organize the communication bits into reasonable arrangements. Verbal bits require considerable effort in this direction, so you can use charts and graphs and pictures and other organized aids, which will, of course, reduce the effort needed here. The third one is after the bits have been sorted and arranged, the brain is faced with the problem of storing the bits needed for future use. So storage efficiency and the speed of recalling information are gained whenever it is possible to store a single bit, usually a visual one, instead of multiple bits of descriptions. This increased efficiency is especially notable in dealing with concepts, theories, and other abstract ideas. So what are the reasons for using instructional aids? Getting and holding students' attention is essential to learning. Visual aids which support the topic cause both the seeing and the hearing channels of the mind to work in the same field. And remember, the instructor is a salesman or a saleswoman of ideas, and many of the world's sales techniques for getting the attention of clients are worth considering. One caution, get students' attention on the subject. Don't just use distracting gimmicks. An important goal of all instruction is for the student to retain as much of the instruction as possible, and certainly, of course, the key points. Many studies have been made to determine the effect of instructional aids on learning retention. While the specific results of the studies vary greatly, from modest results in which retention increases 10 to maybe 15%, to studies in which retention is increased as much as 80%, all agree that a significant improvement in student retention occurs when instruction is supported with meaningful aids. One problem which plagues instructors is to use words which have the same meanings for the student as they do for the instructor. The problem is compounded by floods of new technical terms, the differing vocabularies of people involved, and in some cases, by the need to communicate across the barrier of different languages. Use of visual instructional aids plants in the student's mind the same mental picture that is visualized by the instructor. The good instructor or teacher makes learning easier and more accurate for the student to provide visual images. It is often difficult, too, for a student to understand the relationships between the materials and the concepts. If the relationships are presented visually, they are much easier to deal with. For example, the subsystems within a physical thing are relatively easy to relate to each other through the use of schematics or diagrams. Symbols, graphs, and diagrams can also show relationships of location, size, time, frequency, and value. By symbolizing the factors involved, it is even possible to visualize relationships between abstracts. Instructors are frequently asked to teach more and more in less and less time, so instructional aids can help them do this. Instead of using many words to describe a sound or an object or function, the instructor plays a recording of the sound and shows a picture of the object or function. Consequently, the student learns faster and more accurately. Let's go over, though, some guidelines for the use of instructional aids. The use of any instructional aid must be planned on its ability to support a specific point in a lesson. A simple four-step procedure can be used to determine if and where aids are necessary. Let's talk about these four things. The first one, we need to clearly establish the lesson objective. Be certain of what is to be communicated. This is the most important step. Next, gather the necessary data by researching for support material. Third, organize the material into an outline or a lesson plan. The plan should include key points that are to be presented. And finally, only after completing the previous steps, determine what ideas should be supported with instructional aids. The aids should be concentrated, remember, on the what? On the key points. Aids are often appropriate when long segments of technical descriptions are necessary, when a point is complex and difficult to put into words, when instructors find themselves forming mental visual pictures, or when students are puzzled by an explanation or description. Aids should be simple and compatible with the learning outcome to be achieved. Now, obviously, an explanation of elaborate equipment may require detailed schematics, but less complex equipment may lend itself to only basic shapes or line figures. Since aids are normally used in conjunction with a verbal presentation, words on the aid should be kept to a minimum. The instructor should avoid the temptation to use the aids as a crutch. In many cases, visual symbols or slogans can replace extended wordage. The tendency toward unnecessarily distracting artwork should be avoided. Aids have no value in the learning process if they cannot be heard or seen. Recordings of sounds or speeches should be tested for correct volume and the quality in the actual environment in which they're going to be used. So visual aids must be visible to the entire class. All lettering and illustrations must be large enough to be seen easily by the students farthest from the aids. Colors, when used, should be in clear contrast and easily visible. Numerous rules of thumb can be applied to visibility. The surest and most successful rule is to actually test the aids in the environment in which they will be used. There are many types of instructional aids available, from chalkboards to whiteboards, projected materials such as overheads, and you have models, charts, maps. PowerPoint is a popular one. Interactive CDs and DVDs that actually can be projected for small and large classrooms or crowds. Our final topic of discussion is the use of illustrations. If you want to be a powerful speaker, communicator, or instructor and really reach your listeners, you must, and I repeat, you must master the use of illustrations. An illustration can be made up of examples, parables, metaphors, and comparisons. The advantage of using illustrations, if done correctly, is that it helps people paint pictures in their minds as opposed to hearing words. Now, why is that an advantage? Well, I'm sure you've heard someone say that they can recall or remember people's faces, but they can't remember their names. Why? Names are words. They are intangible, something you can't really see, feel, and touch. This is why they are harder to remember than a person's face. The reason we find it easier to remember a person's face is that the person's face is real, something that you can see, feel, or touch. Your mind can remember the picture of the face. When we speak to our audience by using illustrations, we now convert words into pictures and turn pictures into meaning and reasoning. So let's talk about some key factors that should be included when using illustrations. The first one, they really need to be very clear, concise, and to the point. You don't want them cluttered with a bunch of mumbo-jumbo information. You want them clear, concise, and to the point. The second thing is the person using the illustration must use symbols or words that the receiver understands. Many of my keynote speaking engagements are full of illustrations. I want my audience not only to hear me, but I want them to feel something. I want them to go through many octaves of emotions, from maybe crying to pain to laughter. They will remember the message a lot longer this way. Now remember, a good presentation lasts an hour. A great presentation lasts a lifetime. So if you want to impact an audience, you must take time to create illustrations. Master the ability to do this. Now, if you create an illustration that doesn't seem that good, most likely your audience is going to feel the same way. So make it a point to create a better one. The illustrations are out there. You just have to have the patience and the discipline to find them. Now, let me share with you a few illustrations that I use. Often when I'm telling an audience my story about my past, I want them to feel some of the emotional pain that I've been through. Here's how I do that. After sharing with my audience that my wife told me that the baby that we had wasn't mine, I then illustrate the pain to the audience by saying, "It felt like someone pulled my heart out and rubbed it on a cheese grater." Oh, can you feel the pain with that illustration? Sure you can. Pretty painful, isn't it? That's the power of using illustrations, and that's only one sentence. So start by creating illustrations that are only a sentence or so long. Here's another one I've come up with. Positive thinking is like spray paint on rust. It doesn't last long. With this illustration, your mind can picture paint on rust. And you know what that would look like, and you know that the rust would just keep eating at the metal, thus making the paint useless. Once you get the hang of it, speak for several minutes using an illustration. This way, you can capture your audience for longer lengths. I'll give an example of that. I have a presentation entitled Going Beyond Positive Thinking. Now, what I want my audience to walk away with in this presentation is that you have to go beyond the positive thinking stuff. Positive thinking without action gets you nowhere. So I go on about 10 minutes or more proving this point simply by using illustrations. I'll share some of it with you. If you've been to one of my programs before, you may have heard this illustration, and now we'll take it into great detail. I start off by saying, imagine for a moment that I invite all of you over to my house, and I'm going to go ahead and bake up some cookies. So I get the cookies all baked up, and oh, they smell so good. Now I pull the cookies out, and I hand them to you individually. And as you all take a bite of them, simultaneously, you look at me and say, "Gary, something just doesn't taste right." And now I look over to the counter, and you know what? You're absolutely right. I forgot to put the eggs in the ingredients. Now, I don't think you have to be professional chefs here or rocket scientists, but how many of you here would agree that for most cookies, not all cookies, but for most cookies to taste right, you usually have to have eggs in the ingredients? Could I see a show of hands? Sure you do. That makes sense. So I look over to the counter, and you know what? I forgot to put the eggs in the ingredients. So I go ahead and get the eggs out of the bowl, and I crack them, and I mix the eggs now in the bowl, get them all mixed up, all the raw eggs, and I take your cookies back from you individually, and I dip it in the raw egg. Ugh, now look at your faces. Now some of you don't think that sounds too good, but did we not agree, not even 20 seconds ago, that if we wanted the cookies to taste right, we had to have eggs in the ingredients, yes or no? Yes, but would you also agree with me that there's a difference between having eggs in the cookie or on the cookie? Ah, so friends, you tell me, if we wanted these cookies to taste right, technically, we'd have to start from scratch. You see, friends, positive thinking is like raw eggs. Raw eggs by themselves is pretty disgusting. But if you take the raw eggs and mix it with the proper ingredients, now you can get results. Positive thinking is the same way. You can think yourself positive all day long, but you'll get nowhere unless you put it together with the right ingredients. Now you'll create a positive attitude and you'll become unstoppable. What I just shared with you really is a powerful example of the use of illustrations. Let's take this illustration now and dissect it in detail so we can truly understand what went on. I first started off by getting your attention. I set you up mentally and I said, imagine for a moment. I'm starting off here to help you prepare yourself to get a picture in your mind of being at my house. Then I talk about the cookies and I said I put them in the oven and oh, they smell so good. I'm trying to get you to imagine the smell. Then I take them out and I pass them out to you individually. Then I got you to take a bite and then we agreed that something didn't taste right. Then we started figuring out what the problem was and I said, you know, I looked over to my counter there and you know what, you're right, we forgot to use eggs in the ingredients. Keep in mind what I did before that. I said to you that not all cookies, but for most cookies to taste right, wouldn't you agree that you have to have eggs in the ingredients? So you agreed with me. The reason I said not all cookies, but for most cookies to taste right, that's to knock down the people out there who want to be, well, wait a minute, you know, if you're vegan and you don't have eggs, you can cook cookies without eggs in them. And that's true and okay, but the reason I said it this way, for most cookies, not all cookies, but for most cookies to taste right, wouldn't you have to have eggs in the ingredients? The reason I say it that way is because I don't want to distract anybody out there that says, wait a minute, you can cook cookies without eggs. Yes, you can, but for most cookies to taste right, you need eggs in there. I try my best not to distract anybody, even though that's true, you can do cookies without eggs. I want them to stay focused, and I'm trying to get them to stay right on the illustration and not get sidetracked by saying, but wait a minute, yeah, you can do cookies without eggs. That's the only reason I've added that little sentence in there. Now that I've got you agreeing that you do need eggs for most cookies to taste right, I'm now going to take your cookies back from you because they don't taste right now because they don't have eggs in them, and we're going to get the raw eggs, and we're going to dip the cookies in them, and now everybody's face, See, they can see, they can feel that, yuck, they can paint that picture in their mind. Then I say to them, did you not agree, not even 20 seconds ago, that you have to have eggs in the ingredients? And then they shake their head, yes. So at this point, they're agreeing with me. I'm not being negative. I'm not making them look stupid. I continue with more agreement by saying, wouldn't you also agree with me that there's a difference between having eggs in the cookie or on the cookie? And they're all agreeing again. They're painting the picture. It makes sense. Oh yeah, there's a big difference. They can see, they can feel that. Then I continue with the rest of the illustration. That is how you use illustrations. It takes time to create them, but once you've created them, you can create an incredible, powerful impact with your audience. Again, you're not going to just have a presentation that will last an hour. You'll have a presentation that will last a lifetime. Well, this is going to conclude our program. I know I've given you a tremendous amount of information here, but the bottom line here is if you really want to be effective, if you want to be a good communicator, a good teacher or instructor or speaker, you've got to learn these tools. You've got to learn to master them. And when you master them, you'll know it right away. How will you know it? You will know it because the people that you're talking to, their behavior will start to change. They just won't clap and say, wow, great. They'll do something with the information and it will change their behavior. And that is when you will feel an incredible, incredible reward. May you remember that dreamers, yes, true dreamers, never sleep with their eyes closed. Sweet dreams.